Live and local on AM 770 KTTH. Your independent conservative host, Todd Herman, welcomes you to The Todd Herman Show.
Today is the day the Lord has made, and I am thankful to be living this day with you. These are the times in which God has decided we shall live, and He is telling us in every way you can listen, guys, you got a unique set of responsibilities, and I'm counting on you. One reminder, at 9 o'clock, about an hour from now, Alex and I are going to be taking your phone calls for a segment that's going to air next week. So big topics, things that are continue to be in the news, or big questions for me, or challenges, you disagree with me on something, or I don't cover something in the right way, or maybe just an interesting question. We can even talk about faith if you want to do that. In fact, I'd love to do that. So 800-465-8770. It is Friday. That means that we bring in a radio legend. Stop the bumper music for Herman. Start. I did that so well, and then I screwed it up. Stop the bumper music for Herman. Bring on the bumper music for Mons. There it is. He's stepping up to the podium. Diet Coke in hand.
Man, I can't wait for next Friday now.
Broadcasting from our sidewalk shack, constructed this morning outside of our East Lake Radio studios.
I don't understand why we're not laser focused on the basics of educating kids.
Here we go.
Jeez.
Three,
okay.
Two, one, zap him.
No, no, Yoko.
Oh, man.
Whoa. Holy criminy. That is really.
Jory, welcome. I was kind of digging Bob Seger down on Main Street. I could have lived with that. That would have worked just fine for me there.
Nah, I've stolen that from Bob Seger for my personal notes segment. He can't have it back. So welcome back to the program. Okay. Glad to have you.
You know, I think we're living in wondrous times, Todd. As one of my listeners pointed out to me yesterday, Donald Trump took out ISIS and terror mastermind Soleimani. And so far in the Biden administration, we've taken out Mr. Potato Head and Dr. Seuss.
That's Potato Head to you, buddy. Don't you come on my show with that nonsense. That's Potato Head. We don't do that.
Really good trajectory here.
Yeah. So I wanted to ask you, in regards to Dr. Seuss, which was the most racist character, Thing 1 or Thing 2?
I actually went into all of those books because I remember reading If I Ran the Zoo to our girls when they were little. And Dr. Seuss, we had a huge Dr. Seuss collection. We had a kid's bookshelf in the living room. And I loved reading to our girls. And we would do it when they were 2 days old. Bring them home from the hospital, start feeding them, and read a book to them. And I think it's worked. I think it's paid off because my girls, now adults, are still pretty voracious readers. But Dr. Seuss, we would, you know, when they were even a year and a half, 2 years old, I would tell them, go pick out the book that you want. And at that age, Dr. Seuss was the one they wanted. And so I couldn't remember anything in If I Ran the Zoo, but there were a couple of drawings. In one of the books, they talked of a Chinaman who eats with sticks. And he had yellow skin. He was the only human with yellow skin. Well, about 10 years later, Theodore Geisel, Dr. Seuss, said, you know, I don't want to leave it as is. I want to freshen it up. And so he said, a Chinese person who eats with sticks, and the character was no longer yellow-skinned. So he was even trying to soften things up himself because, by all accounts, the man doesn't have a racist bone in his body. Here's what really frosts me. Am I going on too long? Because I'm really passionate about
this. I'm sorry. I was eating breakfast. I was just... Because, you know, you get hungry hosting a radio show when you're on your 16-8 fast. I'm on just the last portion of my 16. So I'm sorry. Just go ahead, Dory. Just take over the show.
Oh, man. I thought I was doing my show for a second there.
No, Nicole, where's the sound clip?
I've read all of these headlines and news stories about these racist books. A book is made of paper and ink. A book cannot be racist. An author can be. But there's no indication anywhere that Dr. Seuss was a racist. So to call something that was written 70 years ago a racist book by 2021 standards, it just shows how precious everybody thinks their thinking and feelings are, and that if somebody ever in history doesn't conform to how I feel right now today, yep, then they're horrible racists. And it's insane. It's absolute insanity.
I asked my mom once, you know, when we had our daughter, could you bring the Dr. Seuss books? Because we had a massive collection of them. So my mom brought over the Dr. Seuss books. She says, oh, Cat in the Hat. And I said, this is it. I'm going to read Cat in the Hat to my daughter for the first time. So I dramatized it a bit and did some voices. And Dory, one of my favorite two moments of life as a father, well, as life, frankly, was when I was reading Cat in the Hat and the cat knocked on the door and I stopped reading and I turned to my daughter. I said, should they let the cat in? My daughter looked at me. She didn't look away from the book. She just took her head down. She goes, no, bad cat. She could sense that. And then when thing one and thing two arrived and they were going to let him out of the box, my daughter shifted really uncomfortably in bed, like, you know, shifting around. Oh, I can't stand the suspense. Should they let them out? No.
Right.
So we've all had those moments with these books, and I agree with you that they haven't. I mean, I understand people's view of a yellow person. Okay, fair enough. But people do eat with chopsticks in China. In fact, I like chopsticks. I was talking about that last hour. And then Michelle Obama read this to kids, and she's pretty hypersensitive about race, or at least she plays that role on TV. But you're talking to someone on your show who had an incredible experience with Seuss and capitalism. Let's talk about that.
Okay, and by the way, Kamala Harris, 4 years ago Tuesday on March 2nd, yes, Read Across America Day, Kamala Harris sent out a tweet praising Dr. Seuss, and now it's her party that's trying to take him down. It's just, it is insane.
Well, but I mean, no, so in her defense, she was Indian American back then. She's African American now. So
yeah, that's a good point.
She's become more sensitive.
So, I don't know if I'm going to catch up with this guy, but I got an email from a listener this morning, and he's a very active trader on eBay, and he has hundreds of Dr. Seuss books. So he thought, I'll just see what kind of action I can get. And he put up the banned books, which he said would ordinarily have fetched about $10. And he said it was crazy that all of a sudden they went up to 50, 100, 150, 200 with hundreds of people watching in the auction who were going to dive in to drive it up even more. And he might have gotten $500. But all of a sudden he got a message from eBay saying that those books violate their terms of service and that they can no longer allow auctions of Dr. Seuss books. In fact, here, I'm just pulling up his email right now because I want to make sure I get this exactly correct for you. Okay, I didn't pull the email. So anyway, but they pulled the auction. Now, here's the interesting thing. They said because the books are offensive. On eBay right now, you can get a copy of Mein Kampf in almost any condition you can afford. You can buy the works of Minister Louis Farrakhan, which are hate-filled and divisive, but you can't get If I Ran the Zoo by Dr. Seuss. What does that tell us about the world in which we live?
Yeah, I just went to eBay and I have deleted my Amazon account. I no longer have one. I will be deleting my eBay account, which I only got as an alternative to Amazon. You know what else you can buy is the Manson Family Sings the Songs of Charles Manson. Most people don't know that Charles. In fact, you know what? Dennis Wilson with the Beach Boys had a fascination with Manson, and they recorded one of his songs. In that song, it's Manson begging you to let you kill him, let him kill you. And they changed the lyrics slightly to Never Cease Not to Love. There's the Charles Manson Invisible Tears Russian 1 song. You can purchase that. Suicidal Tendencies t-shirt. So, yeah. Oh, hey, here's a Charles Manson painting. A mass murderer is okay, but Dr. Seuss is not okay on eBay, so I will be ending my account with them. Well, we're going to continue our discussion with Dory. Speaking of murder and death and mayhem, Seattle is the leftist lab. It's a separate country. It is a secessionist city. It's past an anarchist city. Dory's going to explain the pending massive crisis at our southern border and something going on in the leftist lab of Seattle. So for our folks who listen in Texas and Florida and New York, Massachusetts, yet another opportunity to learn from the leftist lab of the separate country called Seattle. We'll do that after a quick glance at So Dory, I am blessed with an audience that lives in our area, so loyal to this program, like your audience, although I've been a quarter of the time you have, and then outside the area because of our dearly departed friend Rush and EIB. We have a lot of people who listen to us outside the area. So I want to hear, you were talking about the pending border crisis, the actual border crisis and fentanyl. So let's talk about that.
Well, this is because we do have a crisis at the border. Did you see when Joe Biden was asked about that a couple of days ago?
Yes.
And they asked him, do you have a crisis at the border? He said, no. And they said, what did you learn? Because he had a briefing. Yep. A lot. And the man had no clue what he was saying. And then he just shuffled off. But yes, we have a border crossing crisis. It has exploded. 6,000 illegal crossings a day the last several days. We're on a pace to quintuple the number of last year when President Trump was president. And many of those people are mules who are bringing across deadly drugs like fentanyl. So we had a record number of fentanyl overdose cases in Seattle, King County, the Puget Sound area in the last year, and skyrocketing. And now fentanyl is going to flood our state. And for proof of that, you have a governor, Jay Inslee, who's still in the midst of a crisis, is saying that we're a sanctuary state. And in fact, Alex, play what Jay Inslee said a few months ago about even in the midst of the COVID crisis, continuing to welcome illegals to our state.
While they're waiting for their asylum hearings, we're welcoming them to the state of Washington because we have found these folks frequently become pillars of our community.
Okay, they're pillars of our community. So 6% of the people who have crossed the border have tested positive for COVID. And so they don't get tested at the border. They went into Brownsville, Texas, and the city of Brownsville did the testing, and then they just let them go. And then they can go anywhere they want in the country. One woman was traveling with her daughter, and she got on a bus for North Carolina, and she was positive for COVID. So this is a super spreader event at the border, but Jay Inslee wants to bring as many illegals who've crossed the border to Washington as possible. And so on one hand, he says we must do everything. Wash your hands, wear 5 masks. We got to do everything to stamp out COVID. At the same time, he's welcoming illegals into our state, many of whom are going to be positive for COVID-19. It's crazy. It is absolute craziness, Todd.
No, it is. And it's made worse for me that I've got to find this because it's rare that I see a report like this from the Seattle Media 5. No, you know what? You know what? My Northwest. MyNorthwest.com, it's connected to our parent organization, ran a piece about cartels being, you know, seizing this opportunity within Washington State. I'm so embarrassed that I didn't have that on my rundown this morning. That My Northwest ran this piece. I was so proud of that editorial team to recognize this and to talk about that because, you know what, our communities, we need to shed light on this and lift the voices of families who do not want this in their communities. And Dory, I shared with you, I didn't get a chance to follow up on it because I was doing the show for our departed friend Rush. I didn't get a chance to do it on my own show. I got a note from a friend of mine who's a cop. They're seeing regular instances of execution-style murders now in Seattle. And my friend Kevin, the cop, says people have no idea what's coming and that the cartels are absolutely, the war has intensified. And remind me, it was you, I think it was you, yes, it was you, who interviewed a family who had banned so-called Governor Jay Inslee from a memorial service for a fallen officer killed by an illegal immigrant. Am I correct?
Yeah. I spoke to the brother of the fallen Kittitas County deputy, and they Jay Inslee wanted to come to this trooper's. I think he was a deputy, actually. They wanted to come to his funeral, and the family said absolutely not. They banned Jay and Trudy Inslee from their loved one's funeral because they believe his policy of welcoming in illegals. Of course, it led to their brother's death when it was an illegal who killed the brother. Let me give you a couple of other stats, because I did talk about that fentanyl study that you talked about, or you were just mentioning. We've seen a 92% increase in fentanyl seizures, 230% increase in Eastern Washington. And then one other thing. You know how King County and Seattle want to open these heroin death sites? The government calls them the safe injection sites.
Yeah.
I don't use government speak. I think it's despicable to give a message to little kids that there's a safe way to shoot this deadly addictive poison into your arm. But they want to open these safe injection sites, and they model it after the one in Vancouver, British Columbia. Just got a report this week, Todd. 165 people died from drug overdoses in British Columbia in January alone. So this safe injection site apparently hasn't been so safe. And maybe my terminology of it being a heroin death site is a little more accurate, because people are dying en masse. They're dying in our state because of Governor Inslee's sanctuary policies. And now we have open borders. So when you have this deadly triangle of Joe Biden opening up the borders, wide open, Jay Inslee welcoming people into our state, and then the drug cartels, which are profiting off both of those political ideals, we literally have a governor and a president who are in bed with drug cartels right now. And it is nauseating.
That's absolutely right. Yeah, I call them government-funded heroin dens, and I would like to remind people in Seattle, in the separate country of Seattle, and in Washington State and outside, you may not know this. The citizens of King County voted against the government-funded heroin dens, and then a so-called judge, Veronica Alicia Galvan, who bragged about her role as the resistance. She said on Facebook, I got exclusive access to a lecture she gave young up-and-coming kids who wanted to be in what we would think of the judicial system. She described it as a resistance movement, resistance in a black robe. She then stole that vote. It went all the way up. She said, no, you don't get to vote against government-funded heroin dens. That went all the way up to the Seattle Supreme Court, which used to be the Washington State Supreme Court. They let that stand because we don't get to vote on any health care policies if it involves a change in budget. It is an insipid, insipid excuse. I wanted to ask real quickly, we've got about 2 minutes left. I recall, if I'm correct, did you not track down the funding to the government-funded heroin dens in Vancouver, Canada? Did that not go back to the guy that you're not supposed to mention on Fox News?
Really? Oh, yeah, that's right. They went crazy when somebody tried to mention him.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's unquestionable that one arm of George Soros's philanthropy has donated to the drug den in Vancouver, BC. I have been trying and trying to find a direct connection between Soros and these planned heroin death sites in Seattle. In Seattle and King County. I haven't been able to definitively tie Soros to the effort in our country and in our state. But yes, that is no doubt, and that is 100%, that George Soros is a contributor to the heroin death site up in Vancouver. And now look at what you get from getting in bed with a socialist. 165 people in that province died in January from drug overdoses. They are going in the wrong direction. But this is part of the plan. It's part of the George Soros plan. It's part of the Shamba Sawant plan. Destroy these cities from within, tear them down, and then we'll rebuild in a Marxist image.
Well, maybe they can save some lives with what Jason Rantz, our colleague here, 3 to 6 p.m. on KCTH, discovered was taxpayer money for the booty bumping kits so that you can put the drugs into your rectum. So maybe we should just take that to Canada. That'll save a bunch of lives. Dory, I always appreciate you having you on noon to three, Car Radio, our sister station. I know there'll be big things afoot on this Friday, Dory Monson Show. Thank you for coming on, my good friend, and go
with
God's good grace.
Have a great weekend to you and your listeners.
See ya. Appreciate it. Todd Emmer Show will continue. One reminder, Alex and I are going to be taking and recording your phone calls at 800-465-8770 coming up at 9 a.m.
Who's going to steal the show? You know, baby, it's the guitar.
It's your turn to text the Todd Herman Show.
The rule's pretty simple.
Be concise, be precise, and drop the mic. 800-465-8770.
That same phone number, 800-465-8770, Alex and I are going to stay after school today and chat with you guys on the phone. So big topics that are going to be in the news next week, things we know aren't going anywhere. Love to talk with you about that. We can talk about faith. Love to hear people say, you got this wrong or that wrong. I like those conversations with listeners. We can do that in a civil way and have some fun with each other. So call in 800-465-8770 at 9 a.m., 800-465-8770. And that's for a segment that will air next week. Dave in Ohio. We do really well in Ohio. Man. Thank you, Rush. And enjoy heaven, meeting some of your listeners and Buckley and you up there. Dave in Ohio. The idea that Dr. Seuss was a racist is absurd. If anything, he was an early progressive. He was a staunch supporter of FDR, and his book, The Lorax, was unapologetically environmentalist. While his depiction of Japanese during World War II is considered stereotypically racist, it was very common at the time. Post-World War II, his attitude towards the Japanese softened, and Horton Hears a Who is often considered to be a rebuke of the Allied occupation of Japan. I didn't know that. I've always viewed it as a defense of life. And it is. I mean, a life, no matter how small, it is a defense of that. Sumner Tim, also on the same topic. They have to get rid of Dr. Seuss because Horton Hears a Who might make abortion seem like a bad thing. Planned Parenthood needs to cash in on the fruits of their sex ed bill. Yeah, the one that they're shoving into states around the country. It owns California. It is in Washington State. They have a foothold in Texas. They have a foothold in Georgia. If you ever hear the phrase comprehensive sex education, that is a meaningful phrase. It's not generic. It's a sort of sex ed that contends that all children, no matter their age, are sexual beings with the ability to consent to sexual pleasure and the right to pursue it, no matter their age. Far side of the sound. Now that the leftists have managed to cancel Dr. Seuss, will they now be able to finally expel Shakespeare and Mark Twain from the schools and libraries? What new woke authors will they have our children read? Well, anything that makes America racist, they'll have them read. I think Twain is gone from a bunch of places because he accurately depicted how people spoke in his era. Dr. Seuss, big stinky. That's the message they're scared of. You can choose any direction you choose. That's right. And that's from all the places you'll go. On the topic of the Mockingbird Media and their decision to participate in the hoax from the intel services and the Biden administration that DC was going to be attacked yesterday. You know when the media switched to this Mockingbird platform? I feel like the media couldn't have always been this way and did actual reporting at some time in our history. What caused this change? Definitely something that interests me and would be interesting to research. Yeah, you know what? I would like to find that moment where it all shifted, where it went from leaning left and leftist bias to literal participation in this stuff. Or in the case of CNN, collusion. The New York Times colludes with the Democrats. It's clear as day. Kelly, deadly riot? One woman was shot, and not by a Trump supporter. The others died of natural causes. We're getting tired of this exaggeration. Yeah, the New York Times had reported for a long time, 3 or 4 days, that the officer who died during the riot was beaten in the head with a fire extinguisher. Then later, they quietly disappeared that and then issued a small correction. Judge Weld, Todd, the retired class of 2020, 1 year ago, Thursday, March 5th, 2020, as more cases of COVID reported on the aircraft factory floors, Boeing workers such as engineers and other program support professionals were aware in the late morning of a closed-door, top-down management meeting. At one location, an officer had been sick for 2 weeks with fluish symptoms while continuing to show up to work. Management was compassionate toward that person, but tensions rose within the local office area as to what the risks to coworkers were. In mid-March 5th, 2020, the second-level management emerged back in the office to announce to the engineers and others to go home and work virtually. Virtual work continued for weeks and months with workers leashed to a call-in to work each morning to the team's meetings to report their work progress and their daily plan for the day. Eventually, when aircraft technicians were cleared to work, aircrafts with masks, distancing, and hand sanitation. Yeah, it was a year ago. And we talked about Tony Fauci knowingly lying about asymptomatic transmission and about the PCR tests. Drain the swamp. I think people will get sick when the states open up, not because of COVID, but because their immune system has been sitting idle all year long and hasn't been exposed to germs and viruses. Great point. Staying inside and avoiding vitamin D will do that to you. Great longtime listener to the show, great emailer Adam from Coopville. Good morning, Todd. Remember all those pink hats from the first women's march, in quotes, after Trump was elected? Perhaps we should resort to wearing Dr. Seuss hats in solidarity with sanity. It's Adam from Coopville. Wrap things up today with Steve from Ohio. Like I said, we're doing really well in Ohio. Steve was the first guy I know of who started making our show a habit after he heard me fill in for Rush the first time I did that all those years ago. Steve writes, I wanted to share with you how I did that trick with masks about asking how they worked. Here in Ohio, our libraries are open for limited browsing and computer usage. I was dropping off books when I just had to use the restroom. I ran in, forgetting my mask. I blew past their desk guard, shouting, I was sorry. After doing my business, I came out and there was a mask librarian holding a brand new mask for me and looking annoyed. As he was putting on the mask, I asked how masks work. At first, she thought I didn't know how to put one on, but I clarified, no, how do they work at stopping a virus? She then told me that the masks filter out the virus. I told her that it didn't. And asked if the box the mask came in were there. She said, yeah, it is. Of course, we looked at the box in the fine print mixed with the information size 8 font where the words, does not filter viruses, in black print. This sparked an argument with the librarians that I stayed out of. There were those asking why they're even bothering wearing masks then. Others were saying it's to keep the droplets down. And I added that would be great until the droplets dried out and the virus got through the mask. There was another librarian who went up to get a medical textbook that was a library after all and found the average size of a coronavirus. I don't mean to stir the pot, but I got conversations going. I especially love the cloth mask wearing librarian who said it was a style now. And another librarian saying he hoped that the mask would fall out of fashion soon. I apologized for not wearing a mask when I came in, thanked them for a mask, and then asking if I could borrow the medical textbook about the size of the virus. They said no, since it was a reference book. My parting shot was asking if after 2 weeks of our governor mandating masks, did the virus cases go up or down? The mandate went into effect July 23, and Ohio's peak was in late November. I hope they let me back at the library. I wanted to share this with you and say good luck to your family. I wish you well. Steve from Ohio. Steve, I appreciate that very much. Well done. I don't wear woke masks. I never have. I never will for the COVID. And to answer everybody's question in their head, here's a fun fact. The openings in N95 masks are 0.3 micron. The size, average size of a viral particle of SARS type virus is 0.1 micron. Yes, that is a 300% difference. Yes, that means a bunch of viral particles can fit through. Yes, N95 masks are better than none, but they don't stop viruses either. We'll come back on the Todd Herman Show. Reminder, we're taking your phone calls at the top of the hour. That's Radio Speak, sorry, at 9 o'clock. Call in at 800-465-8770. We're going to pre-record a segment for next week. I want to make this a regular thing so we get to chat more often.
Down on Main Street. Down on Main Street.
On a personal note today, what was the, do you remember the first time you saw your father cry? Or the father figure in your life shed tears? It's kind of a big thing for men the age of my father. My father's passed and all too long ago. That's 17 years ago. But I do remember the first time I saw my dad cry. And I wonder if you remember the first time you saw yours. And what it did to you. Like, there's these moments that we have when kids realize that their parents are not robots and that they're not infallible. I asked my daughter once, when did you figure out that I was, you know, I had flaws? And maybe as a self-defense mechanism, I've forgotten when she actually said that. She's vitally aware that I have flaws. And thank goodness that she is, because none of us are perfect. For me, the first time I saw my father cry, it was a moment that I guess I should have expected, given who he was. He was a guy who had great feeling, but he just had a real hard time letting those feelings out. And so they came out in ways like every time I was in a sporting event, my dad would be there every time and always wearing an orange hunting coat. So he was visible, even no matter how hot it was, even if it was inside, there's the orange hunting coat. So I could look up in the stands and see there's my dad. And that was part of his thing. And then to give me a thumbs up before I went to wrestle or before the football game began or before the car race began, always a thumbs up. I always made eye contact with him. I always appreciated that. And I knew he loved me. And he didn't tell me that until I left town. The day I moved out of my mom's house, which had been their house when they were married. And that's when he said those words. But the first time I saw him cry, well, that was the second time I saw him cry. I was hugging him goodbye. I can remember what he was wearing that day. He was wearing a t-shirt we bought him to celebrate him as our lead pit crew on our quarter midget race cars, and his flannel shirt. He loved his flannel shirts. I have a pillow made out of a flannel shirt that's actually called Grandpa Pillow. It's actually my daughter's pillow. And his cowboy hat. I have that cowboy hat on the dresser in the bedroom. In fact, I have two of them. So I remember him crying then. And that time, it made me feel guilty. I had grown comfortable to saying I love you because of my lifelong friend, who's more like a brother, Matthew, was the first man who actually said I love you to me. First man. We were kids, probably 16, 17 years old. And Matthew's family did that with each other. Like the boys, the brothers said, I love you. The dad said to the sons, I love you. So Matthew said that to me. I remember where I was standing. I was outside Sneva's Auto Garage in downtown Spokane. Matthew was taking a bus to go back to Seattle. He'd been visiting me in Spokane. They'd moved to Seattle. I remember where he was standing. I don't remember what he was wearing, but I can guess because it was always pretty much the same thing. First time I saw my dad cry. We had an old dog. Yeah, you know where it's going. We had an old dog named Duchess. Duchess was the dog my dad bought his kids before the divorce. And my dad made a mistake that resulted in a glorious birth of a wonderful half-brother who is a wonderful man and a wonderful father. So I'm always thankful for him. He made a mistake in the marriage. I think he bought Duchess knowing that he wouldn't be there. Maybe not. Maybe he just wanted a big German Shepherd dog. After all, Duchess lived with us for quite some time, but Duchess was this protector. Duchess was that German Shepherd who guarded the kids. There were time to time in our neighborhood, there'd be someone who'd show up that Duchess didn't know, and her hackles would go up. And eventually, when my dad moved out, we decided Duchess would be happier there where she could run. So the dog of his children moved into his home. She grew fat because she was spoiled, because my dad spoiled her, because he loved her. And my dad was overweight. He just wouldn't care for himself in that regard physically. They grew old together. And then came the point where Duchess couldn't stand anymore on her own. So dad would have to lift her up so she could go to the bathroom, lift her up from behind. Then she couldn't do that anymore. And my dad took her to the backyard. He couldn't let her suffer. So he fed her her favorite snack of peanut butter and crackers. And then she was gone. And my father wept. And then he made me promise something. And it's a promise that I kept with the help of a kind doctor at the UW. When it was clear that he couldn't come back, that he was going to die, my father said, just make it quick. I didn't take my dad's life, I want to be clear. But the doctor did turn up the morphine a lot. I struggle with that. It wasn't my life to take, and I didn't take his life. I struggle with that. Life is precious. My dad's kidneys were done. His liver was done. And I promised my father. I wept. This is the Todd Herman Show. We are every weekday, 6 a.m. to 9 a.m. live on the Pacific Coast. On podcasts everywhere, the Great Rush Limbaugh Program is next. Go be well, be strong, and be kind.